The hospital ran quiet after midnight. Lights low. Halls empty except for the night shift moving with tired focus. A senior nurse stood outside the service elevator with her phone in her hand. She checked the hallway twice before calling a reporter she had never met. Her voice carried a mix of fear and resolve. She said there was a surgeon with power no one understood. She said complaints never stayed on file long enough to matter. She said people were pushed out when they talked. The call lasted less than 2 minutes. No details. Just a warning that something inside that building had been hidden for years. The reporter wrote the time and place in a small notebook and walked out into the cold air. He didn't know if the nurse would ever speak again. He only knew the silence felt planned, and the risk felt real. Chapter 1: The Wall of Silence. The hospital carried a tired heaviness at night. Machines hummed. Floors echoed with small sounds from staff who had done this shift too many times. The reporter walked through the long main corridor with a visitor badge clipped to his coat. He kept his steps slow. He wanted to feel the building before asking anything. The nurse who called him had given no details, only enough to point him here. Her warning sat in his mind. She said the truth had been buried by people who had the reach to do it. He paused at a window facing the parking lot. Rain streaked across the glass. The lot was half empty, the lights flickering in slow intervals. The place looked worn and strained. A hospital should feel structured and alert. This one felt guarded. He reached the nurse's station on the north side. Two nurses worked at the desk. Both looked exhausted, but steady. He introduced himself and said he was waiting for someone who might already be off shift. They nodded with polite caution. No interest, no fear, nothing to show they knew more. He thanked them and stepped away. He didn't expect anyone to meet him tonight. The nurse who called made it clear she couldn't be seen with him. He found a small waiting area near the staff lounge. He sat down, pulled out his notebook, and wrote down everything he remembered from the call. The timing, the tone, the small tremor in her voice. He wrote that she checked the hallway twice before speaking. People only do that when danger is real. He tried to build a picture of who she might be. Long years of hospital work. Exposure to difficult patients and tougher staff dynamics. Someone who had watched something for too long and couldn't carry it anymore. He closed the notebook. He needed to start a trail. Without details, he had to rely on the pattern she hinted at. Complaints disappearing. A surgeon protected by influence. A culture that froze people in place. He visited the public records terminal near the administrative wing. It held general postings, hospital reports, and funding notices. He scrolled through the last 5 years of staff recognition awards. The surgeon's name appeared often. Not just once or twice. Many times. Research grants. Board acknowledgments. Donor events. His reputation was polished and public. The hospital used him in campaigns to show excellence and stability. There was pride wrapped around him. Pride makes institutions cling to people. The reporter looked for HR postings next. Nothing showed staff discipline, which was expected. But the pattern felt too clean. Hospitals have disputes, complaints, friction. This one looked silent. Silence can be manipulated. He shut the terminal and moved toward the administrative offices. He didn't expect access. He only wanted to walk the hall. The framed photos on the wall displayed leadership. Steady faces meant to project control. The surgeon's picture hung near the center. Confident posture, sharp eyes, expression unreadable. The caption listed his surgical outcomes and teaching record. There was nothing to show conflict. No tension. Only success. A door opened behind him. He turned as a woman in a gray blazer stepped out with a folder. Her badge said Associate Administrator. She glanced at him, then at his visitor badge. "You're here late," she said. "I'm doing some early research on a story about hospital innovation," he said. She didn't smile. "This isn't the time for tours. If you need media access, contact the communications office." He nodded. She watched him longer than necessary. Her eyes held a quiet warning. She didn't say anything else. She walked down the hall, heels clicking in sharp pulses. He wrote her name down. People who warn without being asked often know more than they say. As he left the wing, he saw a man leaning against the far wall. Scrubs. Backpack slung low. The man didn't look at him directly, but his posture shifted. He seemed to study the reporter from the corner of his eye. The reporter slowed his pace until he reached him. "Long night," the reporter said. "All nights feel the same here," the man replied. The reporter didn't push. He waited. The man kept his voice low. If you're asking questions about that surgeon, be careful. People tried before. The reporter asked what happened. People got moved, the man said. Some left. Some went quiet. Files don't stay where they should. Did you see anything? The man shook his head. I saw how fast things disappeared. That's enough. He walked away before the reporter could ask more. The reporter wrote down the exchange. It matched the nurse's warning. Something had been run through filters here. Serious allegations leave patterns even when erased. Transfers, silence complaints, missing paperwork. All signs of a controlled environment. The reporter needed someone who had stepped outside the system. Someone who no longer answered to the hospital. He checked the directory for former staff. He found a name tied to the surgical wing who resigned 3 years earlier. He made a note to contact her first thing in the morning. He left the hospital and walked across the lot. Rain hit harder now. The cold pushed through his coat. He reached his car and sat behind the wheel, letting the engine warm. He opened his laptop and filed the first set of records requests. HR logs. Staffing charts. Incident reports within certain dates. He didn't expect a fast reply. He expected resistance. His phone vibrated. A number he didn't recognize. He answered. A quiet voice said, "Stop looking into this." The line clicked off. He sat still for a long moment. The rain hammered the roof. The nurse's warning and the man's whisper in the hallway pressed against him. He didn't know the full truth yet, but he felt its shape. It lived in fear, transfers, and polished reputations. He drove out of the lot. The road ahead was slick and dark. The investigation had barely started, yet pressure already circled him. Someone didn't want questions asked. Someone with reach. He tightened his grip on the wheel. He needed the former staff member. She held the key to the closed door meeting hinted at earlier. If he reached her, he might get the first clear line toward what this hospital worked so hard to hide. That thought carried him into the night. Chapter 2, Cracks in the Shield. The former staff member agreed to meet in a small coffee shop across from a strip mall clinic. She chose a table near the back, facing the door. She wore plain clothes and no badge, but her posture still looked like hospital work. Straight back, eyes always tracking movement. The reporter introduced himself and placed his notebook on the table where she could see it. No recorder yet. He knew some people needed a slower start. "I'm not here to relive everything," she said. "But I'm tired of pretending nothing happened." He nodded and waited. She watched him for a long moment before speaking again. "I worked nights on the surgical floor for 8 years," she said. "I saw how that surgeon moved around people. Compliments that went too far. Hands that stayed where they shouldn't. You tell yourself you imagined it, until you noticed the pattern." She spoke about comments that felt off at first. Small remarks about appearance, posture, clothing. Then more direct lines. Too personal. Too familiar. She gave one example of a resident cornered in a supply room. No contact described, only pressure. The resident transferred departments 3 weeks later. On paper, it looked like a career adjustment. Off paper, people whispered about it for months. The reporter asked if complaints were filed. "Some tried," she said. "I saw two nurses go to HR within a year of each other. Both came back looking shaken. Nothing changed after. No shift in schedules. No visible consequence. Just more tension." He asked for names. She gave them. Her voice caught on the second one. The woman moved out of state. The reporter wrote every detail down. He kept her descriptions clear in his notes. These were allegations, not proven events. But they carried weight in their repetition and in the way they tracked with transfers. "What made you leave?" he asked. She looked past him toward the window. "There was a meeting," she said. 3 years ago. They called it a safety and culture review. It was not on the regular calendar. Only certain people got invited. Leadership. Legal. A few department heads. Word spread that something serious had happened with that surgeon and a staff member. The rest of us only heard fragments. She said after the meeting, the mood on the floor changed. One nurse took sudden leave. Another requested a transfer. Whispers rose, then died. The surgeon stayed. His schedule barely shifted. "I decided then that I had hit my limit," she said. "If they could hold that meeting and still protect him, nothing would move. So I walked away." The reporter asked if she had anything in writing. Emails. Memos. Notes. She opened her bag and pulled out a folded paper. It was a photocopy of a memo header. No body text, but the subject line read, "Confidential Staff Concern Review, Surgical Services." The date matched the period she described. The sender and recipients were senior leadership and legal. It was not proof of wrongdoing. It was proof that serious concerns reached the top. He asked if he could keep a copy. She nodded. "I want this out," she said. "Even if they deny every word, I want the record that people tried to speak." He recorded her with consent after that. She restated what she saw as allegations. His questions stayed locked on what she observed and what others told her directly. No speculation. No leaps. By the time they finished, the coffee shop had emptied. She pulled her jacket close. "You know they will come after anyone who talks," she said. "They already called me," he said. "From a blocked number." She closed her eyes for a second. "Then you know what you're walking into." He thanked her and left. The memo header went into a separate folder. One document alone meant little. Paired with records and interviews, it could mark a turning point. Back at his office, he requested staffing logs from the union representative for the hospital. It took 2 days before a reply came. The union rep agreed to meet near the union office in a cramped conference room that smelled of old paper. The rep was direct. "We have seen staff shifted off that floor for years," he said. "No official reason beyond vague fit issues. Sometimes we get told it is workload. Sometimes it is personality clashes. It is never written as retaliation. But you look at the timing and you start to see the pattern." He slid a sheet toward the reporter. It listed names, job titles, departments, and dates of transfer. No one word pointed to harassment. Yet the clusters lined up around known tension periods on the surgical floor. "Can you tie this to complaints?" the reporter asked. "Not cleanly," the rep said. "We fight for people when they come to us, but not everyone does. Some just leave. What I can say is that whenever someone pushed back around that surgeon, something in their assignment shifted within months. That is not proof. It is a strong signal." The reporter wrote those words down exactly. Not proof. A strong signal. Allegations supported by circumstantial movement. He asked if leadership ever documented a concern about the surgeon. The rep gave a short laugh. "If they did, it never came across my table," he said. "They treat him as an asset. Brings in funding. Brings in prestige. Hospitals protect assets." After the meeting, the reporter received a reply from the hospital legal office. The message was formal and controlled. It stated that the hospital did not comment on personnel matters and that it followed all laws and policies related to workplace conduct. It offered a generic statement about zero tolerance and support for staff. He read it twice. The language held no specifics, no dates, no mention of investigations. It felt scrubbed. That night, his phone buzzed with a different number. This one belonged to an anesthesiologist willing to speak off the record. "I have 15 minutes, the voice said. "No names used here. Not mine. Not theirs." The anesthesiologist described a pattern of tension in the operating room. Comments directed at nurses during prep. The surgeon touching shoulders or waists under the excuse of adjusting position. Staff eyes flicking to the floor. No one spoke out loud in the moment. People needed their jobs. "Did you ever see a formal complaint?" the reporter asked. "I saw people walk into HR and walk out looking like they were the problem," the anesthesiologist said. "After that, you start telling each other to stay quiet and be careful." He asked about any specific incident tied to the secretive meeting. "There was a case," the anesthesiologist said. "I will not describe it. It involved a staff member who finally refused to stay quiet. Something serious enough that leadership knew they had to act on paper. I heard about a closed-door review. Afterward, the staff member left the hospital. The surgeon stayed. I call that protection." The reporter noted again that these were allegations and perceptions, not court-tested facts. But the same story kept surfacing. Pressure. Complaints. Transfers. Silence. He asked if the anesthesiologist would ever speak on record. "Not without protections," the voice said. "People who talk get isolated. Some lose privileges. Some never work at that level again. You want someone on record, you will need more than me." The call ended. The weight of the risk sat heavy. The next morning, an envelope arrived at the reporter's office with no return address. Inside was a copy of a confidential internal memo. The header matched the one from the former nurse. This version included the body text. It outlined a sensitive staff concern involving a high-value clinical provider and an alleged pattern of boundary violations. it recommended keeping the matter within a small leadership circle and stressed the importance of limiting reputational exposure while addressing staff concerns. No names appeared. No explicit incident description. Still, the language revealed priority. Protect image. Contain fallout. Manage staff. The memo did not prove harassment occurred. It proved leadership knew of allegations serious enough to prompt risk management language. It proved a decision to treat the matter as something to contain, not expose. The reporter checked the date. It matched the period after the secret meeting. It aligned with staff transfers. It followed the departure of the nurse, who walked away from her job. He stared at the memo for a long time. This was the first document that linked whispers to deliberate strategy. He prepared a new round of questions for the hospital. This time he cited specific dates and referenced a confidential risk memo. He requested comment on whether leadership had received repeated allegations about a single surgeon and what steps had been taken to protect staff. He knew they would feel the pressure now. Specific questions forced specific decisions. Before sending the inquiry, he called the former nurse. "They're going to feel this," he said. "Once they read these questions, someone in that building will know people talked." She stayed quiet, then asked one question. "Is anyone willing to put their name to what happened?" she said. He told her he had off-record witnesses only. She exhaled slowly. "You need someone who will not back down when they push back," she said. "If I find them, I will call you again." He sent the questions to the hospital that afternoon. As the message left his outbox, a single fact became clear. The story had moved past whispers and vague warnings. It now sat on a conflict point between institutional reputation and staff safety. Somewhere inside that hospital, someone would have to decide whether to double down on silence or face what had been buried. That decision would bring the story to a breaking point. Chapter 3: The Break and the Cost. The call came just after 9 in the morning. The reporter was at his desk, going through the hospital's latest non-answer to his questions, when his phone vibrated. The number matched the nurse who had walked away from the hospital 3 years earlier, the one who carried the photocopied memo header in her bag. Her voice was steady this time. "I found someone," she said. "She is still inside." She was in the middle of the incident that led to that closed-door meeting. "She is ready to go on record if you can lay out what protection looks like." He asked where they could meet. She named a quiet community center on the edge of the city. Neutral ground. No crowds. No hospital staff drifting through on break. The reporter arrived early and waited in a small room with plastic chairs and a cracked whiteboard. The witness walked in with the former nurse. She wore hospital scrubs under a plain jacket. Her badge was not visible, but the strain in her eyes told him she had not slept well. He introduced himself and explained that anything she said would be clearly framed. Allegations would be labeled as such. Proven facts would remain separate. He laid the recorder on the table and did not hit the button yet. She folded her hands in front of her. "I am tired of being scared of the place where I work," she said. "If they push me out after this, at least I will know I did not stay quiet." She described the incident that triggered the secret meeting. Her account came in careful segments. One evening shift in the surgical wing. A long case with tension in the room. Afterward, she said the surgeon asked her to stay behind to review professional conduct issues. The conversation took place in a staff room with the door pulled almost closed. She said his tone shifted once they were alone. Comments about her body. An implied trade between career support and compliance. No explicit threat. No direct physical assault described. But she said he stepped into her space. He touched her arm and shoulder. She pulled away. He told her that people who did not fit the culture found themselves better placed elsewhere. She went to HR the next morning. She gave names. Dates. Exact phrases. She said the meeting felt like an interrogation. Questions framed her as sensitive and difficult. She walked out feeling like a risk, not a victim. Her account remained an allegation. No court ruling had tested it. No regulator had issued findings. Still, the level of detail and the way it matched the hospital's pattern of transfers and secretive reviews raised the stakes. He asked about the closed-door meeting. "I was told they took it very seriously," she said. "They said leadership and legal would review. I never heard back about any outcome. I only heard whispers that I was on a list as a problem. Over the next months, my shifts were cut back. My evaluation score dropped with no clear reason. People stopped sitting near me in the break room." She paused and looked at the recorder. "You can use my name," she said. If I stay anonymous, they will act like none of this is real. If I stand in the open, they will have to react. He turned on the recorder. She retold the story in full, knowing it would be on the record. He kept his questions clear and factual. He did not ask her to speculate about motive. He did not put words in her mouth. He let the weight of her account land on its own. 2 days later, a second document arrived at his office. This one did not come in a plain envelope. It appeared through a secure upload link from an anonymous source. The file was an internal risk assessment prepared by the hospital's legal and compliance teams. It referenced a key clinical provider and repeat staff concerns regarding boundary management and power dynamics. This document went further than the earlier memo. It listed leadership positions and described how each had argued against formal public action. It described a decision to handle the matter informally to preserve critical institutional relationships and external funding leverage. The language did not name the surgeon, but dates and context lined up with the witness's account and with his high profile. The risk assessment did not confirm that harassment had occurred. It confirmed that leadership saw enough danger to discuss legal exposure. It confirmed that, when given a choice between full transparency and controlled damage, they chose control. The reporter cross-checked names and roles. Then he wrote a new set of questions. This time, he attached excerpts from the risk assessment and told the hospital he would publish if they did not respond. He requested a sit-down interview with senior leadership to discuss how they handled staff safety when allegations involved powerful clinicians. The hospital answered with a brief message. "Senior representatives will make a statement in person," it said. "No recordings of the internal document will be permitted." The meeting took place in a conference room near the main lobby. The chief executive officer, the head of human resources, and the hospital's legal counsel sat on one side of the table. The reporter sat on the other with his notebook and recorder. He began by reading a compressed summary of what he had gathered. Allegations of boundary violations from multiple staff members over several years. Patterns of staff transfers. Internal memos acknowledging risk. He made clear that all accounts of misconduct remained allegations, and that no court or regulator had yet ruled on them. The chief executive officer's voice started in denial. "We are not aware of any substantiated pattern of harassment by this physician," she said. "We follow legal and ethical standards in all staff concerns." He slid a printout of the risk assessment toward her. "This document describes repeated concerns," he said. "It also names specific leaders who argued against formal action. Can you explain why staff safety and institutional reputation appear in conflict here?" The room shifted. The legal counsel placed a hand flat on the table. "This document was part of an internal legal review," he said. "It does not reflect final decisions. We cannot comment on privileged material." The reporter asked if they disputed its authenticity. They did not answer that directly. Instead, the head of HR spoke. "We acknowledge that concerns were raised about a member of the surgical team," she said. "We address those concerns through internal processes. We regret if any staff felt unheard." The language had moved. The hospital no longer claimed ignorance. They now framed the situation as something handled quietly. Controlled acknowledgement had replaced denial. He asked if the surgeon had ever been removed from patient care. They declined to specify. He asked if staff who complained had faced negative consequences. They said they could not speak to individual cases. Their answers confirmed what the documents already showed. Protection existed where accountability should have stood. Within hours of the meeting, the reporter received a written statement from the surgeon's legal representative. It was polished and firm. The surgeon categorically denied any misconduct. He characterized the allegations as distortions of routine professional interactions and hinted at motivations that will become clear if necessary. He described his surgical record and research impact and stated that he had dedicated his life to patient care and teaching. He said he welcomed a fair review by appropriate authorities. The article went live the next day. It laid out the allegations as allegations. It presented the documents as evidence of what leadership knew and how they reacted. It quoted the hospital's careful shift in language and the surgeon's full denial. It did not tell the reader what to believe. It showed them what existed and where the gaps lay. The public reaction reached the regulators within days. A state health oversight office announced an initial review into the hospital's handling of workplace conduct complaints involving senior clinicians. The announcement avoided names, but acknowledged media reporting and staff concerns. For the first time, the matter no longer lived only inside internal memos and whispered warnings. It sat on an official record. Inside the hospital, the tremor spread fast. Some departments held quiet huddles where people read the article on their phones. Some staff felt a flash of relief that the silence had finally broken. Others felt exposed and angry. They worried that the story would stain all of them, not just those who made decisions or held power. Lines formed along familiar fault points. There were those who saw the surgeon as a target of a smear campaign and closed ranks around him. There were those who had watched the tension for years and now felt their unease finally validated. Conversations that had always taken place in low voices now slipped out into full sentences. Leadership felt the pressure from above and below. The board began to ask direct questions in closed meetings. Who knew what and when? Who argued against taking formal action? Which leaders had signed off on risk management plans that emphasized reputation over safety? Turnover did not happen overnight, but the air around the top floor changed. Consultants appeared. Phrases like succession planning and transition strategy circulated in private memos. People in leadership roles started updating their profiles quietly. The on-record nurse who stepped forward felt the fallout first. Shifts that once fit her life were reshuffled with little explanation. A longtime colleague stopped returning her messages. One manager treated her with tight professionalism, no small talk, no warmth. She could feel the label attached to her now. Not team player. Problem. Liability. The reporter met her one more time in the same community center room. "They have not said anything outright," she said. "But every small move tells me the same thing. They want me to understand that I crossed a line." He asked if she regretted going on record. She thought for a long moment before answering. "I regret that it had to be me," she said. "I regret that nobody listened when people tried quietly. But I do not regret telling the truth. Even if it costs me this job. Even if I have to start over somewhere else." He asked what she planned to do. "I have two choices," she said. "I can stay and try to work under people who would rather protect a powerful surgeon than the people who clean up after his damage. Or I can leave and carry this as something I did not stay silent about." She looked tired but clear. "They talk about patient safety every day," she said. "They never say that staff safety is where it starts. If they cannot protect us from each other, I do not know how they pretend to protect the people in those beds." The investigation did not end with that conversation. Regulators still had to dig through records. Leadership still had to explain themselves behind closed doors. The surgeon's denial still stood in public view. Nothing final had landed. But one truth was already fixed. The story had forced the hospital to face what it worked for years to keep out of sight. It had dragged institutional protection into the open and showed the cost stamped on one worker's life. The last decision left belonged to her, not them. Whether she stayed or walked away, the record would not go back to silence, and that was the one thing they could no longer control.